My guest today says that if evangelicals want to retain their witness or recover their witness for the church, they'll need to find a different candidate than Donald Trump.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We are going to have a very open, candid, important discussion today. I urge you to listen with open heart, open mind, open ears as I speak with my friend and colleague, well-known New Testament scholar, Darrell Bock. Darrell is Senior Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary, as well as Executive Director of Cultural Engagement for the Hendricks Center there. I got a bit of a bone to pick with him. He's written more than 40 books, which makes him ahead of me, but that's all right. So we really want to talk about some very serious issues about evangelicals and the culture, about evangelicals and the president, about issues that are highly volatile like race and racism. And we're going to speak as openly and candidly as we can, not to be offensive, but to be forthright, to be clear, and here and there to bring out certain points, because I'm sure Dr. Bock and I are going to be in substantial agreement on many and maybe in disagreement on some. I'll take the other side of some positions to see what conclusions we come to. So with that, Darrell, welcome back to The Line of Fire. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Michael, it's great to be with you as always, and it's great to hear your voice after seeing you a couple of weeks ago. So
yeah. A very, very pleasant surprise to see in Toronto. So, yeah, so you're ahead of me in books, man. I got to work harder on that, try to catch up. Oh, what are you working on now? Any major projects?
Yeah, we just finished a commentary on Ephesians, and then I've edited a book on method and historical Jesus studies. It'll be out at the turn of the year with Tom Wright having written the foreword. And then I've worked a book on what we're calling cultural intelligence about. It's a theology of cultural engagement, a theology of spaces and places. Be out this time next year with Broadman Holman. That actually is a major project that I'm working on that I'm actually going to put several things around to try and make the point about how we've missed it and how we've engaged and how the culture war has done us damage rather than helped us because we've had the wrong target.
Mm. All right, tell you what, why don't we start there, the church and the culture wars. We'll go from there to the church and the president, and then we'll go from there to some of the most difficult, divisive issues in our culture today. So could you unpack that statement that we've had the wrong target and hence our engagement in the culture wars has actually hurt the church?
Yeah, the key passage here is Ephesians 6:10 to 18, the armor of God passage,
yep.
In which the text says outright, our battle is not, that's emphatic, against flesh and blood. But it's involving spiritual forces and powers in the heavenly places. What the Greek, one of the Greek words is called a cosmocrat. And I say, if you think a bureaucrat's bad, you haven't met a cosmocrat. and so my point is that people are never the enemy. In fact, people are actually the goal. Our goal is to draw people from outside the church into sacred space by inviting them to participate in the gospel. And when we view people as the enemy and make them the enemy, we actually misdirect the spiritual element of what's going on. And the spiritual element and our spiritual defense is really our theology, our character, who we are as a community. Those are the things that are said to be the armor of God, not an ideology, not a particular political stance. And so I think because our target's been misdirected, we've actually done damage to the church and to the credibility of the church in the process because we've tended to make people we've demonized people.
Yeah.
And when you demonize people, you actually don't do a good job of drawing them towards the gospel.
All right, so let me ask this. And this is something I've struggled with often, even writing an article recently, could the church have avoided the culture wars? So you want to kind of focus on what you're saying and give yourself to prayer and good works and sharing the gospel. And then something outrageous happens. Your kid comes home from school crying, some ridiculous sex ed curriculum being pushed on them. And then at your local library, drag queens are going to be reading to toddlers. And then across the street, there's an issue with religious liberties. And you feel, I've got to do something. I've got to speak up. So you're not mean-spirited. You're not screaming and yelling. But you have to take a stand for righteousness and expose evil. Yet at the same time as you do that, you know, as we speak against same-sex, quote, marriage, just my saying that, quote, marriage, now I'm demeaning gay couples. So how do you do the one without the other? I mean, how do you navigate this?
The challenge of being a Christian in the world, this has been true in every decade, in every century, in every millennium, is that on the one hand, you're challenging people with the way that they live, because the world is not what it ought to be. But you're also extending an invitation for a different kind of life. Whenever your challenge so overwhelms your invitation, you've lost the path to the gospel, which means good news. And so I think it's a matter of balancing the tension between what you react. You should never be surprised that the world is the world.
Right.
And so sometimes we pretend that we have this shock, but we have this shock because we have developed a sense of internal entitlement that the society at large ought to be like the church, and the Bible never teaches that. And so so we need to create a right set of expectations for ourselves. We need to correct a right set of expectations for our children as we raise them up in the world. They shouldn't be surprised or shocked by what they see out there, but we ought to help them cope with it. And part of that is how we react to what we see around us that shouldn't catch us by surprise. Jesus said, if you're going to be my disciple, you're going to get pushback from the world. That's coming with the territory. So I think we have coddled ourselves to some degree as Christians in terms of our expectations, and we have unrealistic expectations about what the world is and what the function of the church is in the world. And in the process, we've misdirected our aim, and in misdirecting our aim, we've actually done ourselves damage.
All right. In America, Daryl, is it maybe a bit more precarious for us because we have certain Christian roots in our history? We have certain Christian roots in many of our schools of higher learning. We have certain traditions. For a good period of our history, there was public prayer in our schools. Bible was read in our schools. Franklin Graham was asked, why do you address political issues or cultural issues more than your father did? And he said, in my father's day, they were reading the Bible in the schools. So is this something that we should be cherishing and saying, hey, this is part of what made America great? And we want to try to recover this, not to have a theocracy or think America was ever perfectly Christian, but to say, hey, this is part of our heritage, and it was better than our current direction. Or is that now dangerously mixing nationalism with the kingdom of God?
No, I think you make a case for what makes society work. Okay, I like to tell people, here's how our culture has changed in my lifetime. It used to be you could say it's true because it's in the Bible, and enough people had enough high regard for the Bible to take the Bible, even if they didn't believe it was inspired or inerrant or however they viewed their bibliology. They had a respect for the Bible as at least being wise advice about life. Now you have to make a different kind of argument. Now the argument is it's in the Bible because it's true. That's a different way of arguing, and that's a different kind of argument. And the reason that's important is because what I like to tell Christians is the reason God says what he says is because it's good for life. You know, it's true. This is the way we ought to live. This is the best way for us to engage with one another and to do so in a way that is healthy and flourishing. And we've got to make that case. But we've also got to know how to lose well. Because we've been told if we make that case, if we put that in the public square, the world is going to push back because the world is a dark place. And so you make your case, and what we've been dealing with is the loss of something that was precious, but that period was an anomaly, you know? And so being able to adjust to that, and then to understand that the time when the church was oftentimes most effective is when it had the least social power and the least political power. The early generations of the church had no such power, and yet they functioned effectively because they had a credible witness as to who they were as the people of God. And we've lost that, and we need to recover it, and it certainly is the way we're going to have to deal with the changes that are going on around us that are happening so fast it makes your head spin.
Yeah, and in a moment we're going to look at the larger political issues and Donald Trump specifically and evangelicals and Trump. But Darryl, again, these are things I've wrestled with for years and years, knowing my calling to speak and be a voice, knowing the challenges and the dangers and how easy it is in America to confuse patriotism with the kingdom of God, and knowing also that we may have greatest revival in the worst situation. I just met with some of our grads who serve in China and hearing from them, and again, the church thriving there in difficulties. But do we throw away our liberties? Do we just say, okay, let the whole thing collapse because we can't do well? You know, we tend to do better as the persecuted minority than the ruling majority. But when we have, you know, tens of millions of us, do we just throw away our influence? What do we do?
No, I don't think you throw away your influence. I think you continue to contend for what you believe in. But the key is the second half of what I said earlier. We have to learn how to lose well. We have to recognize that when we operate in the public square, we operate in a shared public square that is pluralistic in its structure, has no inherent religious commitment or conviction, and so, you know, so we make the case for what we believe in, but we may or may not be persuasive in terms of the democratic in terms of democratic numbers and that kind of thing. We actually shouldn't be surprised if that happens.
Right.
And then the question is, how do we respond? Do we respond out of fear? Do we respond out of anger? Do we continue to serve the city? You know, one of the most beautiful passages in the Bible is in Jeremiah, where the Israelites have gone to Babylon, certainly not the most commendable society that's ever been formed by humankind, and they're told to serve the city. And they're told to engage in such a way that they don't lose their integrity as they interact with those around them. See, there's a way to be right, but do it in such a wrong way that you're still wrong. And that's what I'm afraid we've been doing.
Got it. All right, friends, there is tremendous nuance in what my friend Professor Darryl Bach is saying. We've got a break coming up here. I hope you're hearing it. He is, as I said, Director of Cultural Engagement for the Hendricks Center. There's a right way to do these things and a wrong way. And again, it's something, it's a holy tension I deal with all the time, and not claiming I've done anything perfectly either. But this is important for us to hear. We can get so caught up with the political spirit that gets joined with our spiritual causes that we destroy our witness and drive away the very people Jesus came to save. We come back, we'll talk about evangelicals and Donald Trump. Do we need to opt for another candidate in the fall? 2020.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us. I'm speaking with well-known New Testament scholar, Professor Darryl Bach, also a dear friend and co-worker. All right, let us get right to the subject, cut to the chase. Do you feel that evangelical Christians, A, have hurt their witness by either voting for Trump or openly supporting Trump? And B, do you feel that we need to take action to recover our witness if you answer in the affirmative to either of the first two?
Okay. And the first question, the answer is, well, yes, sort of. I don't have a problem with someone who decided to vote for Trump in one sense. They were voting for certain policies and certain ways of life and living that I think in many cases, although not all, were things that reflect commitments that Christians should have. The problem is in the second half, which is the support. The way in which we have supported Trump almost unconditionally, almost excusing certain things that he's done and said, or looking for ways out, things we're defending that 10 years ago we never would have defended because someone had a D by their name instead of an R. That's where the problem is, because that's produced an inconsistency, a moral inconsistency, and an inconsistency in what we stand for that undercuts our credibility, so that when we do speak into the public square on moral issues, people can say to us, why should I believe you? You used to say this, but now you say that, and the only difference is that you like the politics of the person who you now defend, whereas before you didn't like the politics of the person you were condemning. And so I think that inconsistency stands out. It undercuts our credibility, and that's where we've done harm. So, yes, we now need to move into a mode where we speak up and show a better consistency in what we believe in, respond accordingly, hold people accountable for their behavior, that kind of thing, and even be willing to sacrifice some things that we might really believe in for the sake of being morally consistent, and thus enhancing our credibility. But I will tell you, the damage that has been done is very real. It's very long term. It's costing us a generation of people, and I don't know if it's even too late.
Why are you so convinced that the damage is so widespread? And by the way, I'm with you on everything you said. I voted for Trump. I continue to raise issues when I feel there are issues to raise, etc. We've talked, and we'll get to the point in terms of what you think has to be done beyond that, beyond calling things out or expressing differences, etc. So I don't entirely agree with the objection I'm going to raise, but I want to raise it, okay?
Okay.
I know that the left-wing media is constantly inflaming tensions and saying, if you voted for Trump, you're a racist, or if you voted for Trump, the blood of Charlottesville is on your hand, or whatever. And I know the reason that the left is pushing this is not because it's trying to rescue our witness, but because it's trying to drive people away from voting for Trump so he'll lose in 2020. How much of the hostility towards Trump and the hostility towards evangelicals is being inflamed by the left? So I totally agree with you. Many of our leaders have said things. They defend Trump, St. Donald, whatever he does is great. And just you look the other way, and like you're saying, things we never would have accepted 10 years ago, we justify. We look at, well, we're not voting for a pastor, we're voting for a president, whereas we used to say character counts. So I agree with you on that. How much is being inflamed by the left, and why are you so sure that we really have done tremendous damage? Forget the left. We ourselves.
Well, let me deal with the left first. Yes, there is a push coming from the left, and some of the people on the left are raw secularists who don't care a whit about some of the things that we feel very deeply about. I get that. But we're contending for a population that's trying to decide whether they're going to turn to the right or the left. And the more you undercut your capability, the more you risk pushing people to the left side, particularly if they sense there's terrific human injustice in some of the positions that you're defending. When you split families on issues of immigration for whatever reason, and you do so almost without a sense of caring about what's going on, you set yourselves up to push people to the left. And my concern is for the people who are trying to decide between the polls about where they're going to land, and particularly young people. If you actually look at the polling and look at the attention about where young people are and where they're headed, they're being drawn in that direction because they see a heartlessness and a callousness coming from the right that they don't want to connect with. So I think there's a real problem here, and I do think the damage is actually quite deep.
All right. Obviously, you're a professor at a seminary, so you don't have so much college-age students. You've got students older than that and then some well on in age, but you're quite in touch with the younger generation. What are you hearing from younger Christians? What's their perspective?
Well, their perspective is, they're, in one sense, they're perplexed. You know, the values that I grew up with, that you were teaching me when I was a child, I do not see being practiced now. You tell me what I'm supposed to do. And so, like, again, this whole thing is, there's an inconsistency here in which the ends justifies the means, or nationalism has trumped Christian values. There are a whole series of things in which there's an inconsistency, which is transparent. The left, how I say that, exposes that and takes advantage of it. And that's part of the way we do ourselves damage. I sometimes say to people, look, in some senses, we're getting what we deserve. We're getting what we've paid for, because we have not been the consistent Christian witness that we ought to be when it comes to how people are handled, the way you view people of other nations. You know, one of the things that happens to me when I become a Christian is I become connected to people who have nothing to do with the United States.
Yep.
And so... to have some sense about what that responsibility is, and how, you know, I'm sorry, but America First is not a Christian value, and so what God cares about, God so loved the world, so it's those kinds of tensions that I'm talking about, and I think we've just been so inconsistent in the midst of defending some things that ought to be defended. I mean, we ought to defend the baby in the womb. We ought to defend the way in which marriage has been seen for millennia. Those things ought to be done, but we can't do it at the expense of other human rights issues that the Bible speaks very clearly towards. We have to be more discerning. I like to say, no one was more pro-Israeli or more pro-Israel than the prophets, but they certainly could be self-critical, and that's what we're missing.
Yeah, there's. I referenced this in the book that I wrote, Donald Trump is Not My Savior, that there is a professor, he used to be at Jewish Theological Seminary before he passed away, Yochanan Mufz, who wrote an article called His Majesty's Loyal Opposition. And it was about the prophets of Israel and their role in the society as His Majesty's loyal opposition. But then it went to God and the prophets, that God would know, as he was about to bring judgment, there would be a Moses who would say, but God, if you do this, your reputation will be at stake. And he was looking for that Moses to stand up to plead for mercy, and in that sense, God had a righteous excuse because a human was pleading for it to show mercy. When you go over to the prophets of Israel, because they love their nation, they were willing to rebuke and speak the truth, be it to the king, be it to the people, be it to each other. That's part of real loyalty, as opposed to just, I sign on the dotted line and I'm a yes man. So obviously, we have very few of those conservative prophetic voices, because it seems when we do have these conservative prophetic voices, they end up just kind of being baptized into the Republican Party.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think depending on the issue that you're dealing with, in certain cases, there are concerns, frankly, coming from the left that do reflect some closer position to biblical values than some of the positions some on the right take. So I don't think this is a matter of, you know, I think we're past the time of being able to label someone and on the basis of a label accept or dismiss an idea.
I understand.
We've got to get to the point where we assess ideas on the merits. And in some cases, we may need to split some differences between the two views and look for, you know, one of the things that's certainly been lost in my lifetime is it used to be that people in Congress negotiated with each other and tried to find some level of common ground. Those days are so long gone. I mean, it's hard to realize that there was a time when it was being those kinds of efforts were taken seriously. And so the idea of pursuing legislation in certain areas that's bipartisan. I mean, we get nothing done today. There are certainly certain things that ought to be able to be achievable.
Right. And again, what happens is we're inflamed, when I say we, the church, believers, we're inflamed by the news, be it the left or the right. We're inflamed by what's on the social media. Darren, my wife Nancy has just been brokenhearted for days now. It's the main subject we talk about. The state of the church is reflected on social media, where we carelessly, we'll just pass on the the Clintons killed Epstein. You know, we're just pass on the latest meme with no concern about speaking truth or accuracy or what's appropriate or not. So in that sense,
there's a risk of committing slander, outright slander.
Yeah, and we do it freely. If in fact, let me just jump in. If the meme is cute, especially if we get a lot of likes, hey, just put it out. All right, listen, we come back. I want to pursue that and then just ask directly, in your view, is it imperative that evangelicals publicly say we need another candidate other than Donald Trump in the next election? And then from there, we'll go to a non-controversial subject. I'm being sarcastic. Racism. Is there systemic racism in the church, in the society? Is the church aware of it, doing something about it? We'll be right back.
Oh, God of burning, cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today as I speak with New Testament scholar Professor Darrell Bach at Dallas Theological Seminaries. We're talking about the church and the culture and how we can't just say, well, the left is this or the right is this, the conservatives this or liberals this in terms of righteousness and what position is right. Darrell, I just spotted a comment where someone was pushing back and saying, how is the Democrat platform and Democrats espousing of socialism better for the poor than the Republican platform? How would you reply to those who just feel that in terms of social cultural issues, overwhelmingly the Democrats are on the wrong side?
Well, the interesting thing is if you talk to a lot of poor people, they don't think they're on the wrong side. So the question becomes, all right, so how'd that happen? And what does that mean? So you may think in your own view, in your own way of thinking about the poor, that the Democrats don't serve the poor and aren't interested in them, and there might be some points on which you might be correct about that. But my guess is that there is something about the way people are connecting with the poor, are listening to them, are hearing to some of the things that they're saying, rather than being, in some cases, dismissive of them, that draws them to that side. This is part of the magnet picture I was using earlier. You've got people in the middle who are deciding which way they're going to go. How do you communicate in such a way that a person sees, you really do care about me, you do understand my predicament, you do understand that my life is different than yours, and that what I've been through and the circumstances that I've been taken through, the history behind that, you know, and we're probably turning our attention a little bit towards the racism discussion to a certain extent with some of this, that has created an environment in which my opportunities are not your opportunities. Those kinds of things, and so I think these blanket statements that say that one side has it all right and the other side has it all wrong probably is missing on both sides something. And so this is why you need a better, more nuanced, a more careful conversation about what really is in the interest of the poor and how do you communicate real and genuine concern and how much effort do you make to listen to people who are in those circumstances and living out of those circumstances to get some sense about what your policy ought to be.
And so you're a consistent word that you're bringing to us is tone, is communication, is message, and not just the issue we're standing on. So, for example, I grew up in the suburbs, born in New York City in Manhattan, but grew up as a kid in the suburbs and have lived basically my life as middle class. Depends where you put yourself in the middle class, basically middle class suburbs over the decades. And I may have a view about what's best for the poor in the inner city, but I'm not in the inner city, so at the very least, I need to have a conversation with someone in the inner city, especially a fellow believer, and get perspective, and then be able to each understand each other, then put our heads together for a solution. Well, we're going to come back to that in a moment, but I want to just focus on Donald Trump. Is it enough, in your view, if evangelicals say, look, we're put off by this, we don't like this, we have concerns about this, but he is the most viable candidate, he's doing a lot of good on some existential things, the courts and abortion and things for Israel and perhaps standing up against some tyranny in other parts of the world. So we're going to make our differences known. And if he's the candidate, if you know it's hard to unseat a sitting president in the primaries, then, hey, he's our man, but we have our differences and our caveats, and we certainly won't defend him. In your view, is that enough to cover our witness, or do you think we have to do more?
I think we have to make him sufficiently accountable that there is a potential cost for his failure to be responsive in those areas. And so, whether that doesn't necessarily mean choosing another candidate, I'll think it might. I think that here's the question that I have that I often ask the real pro-Trump person. I say, how is it possible that the policies that he is defending could not be defended by another person in a completely different way that would bring more credibility to the church? Okay. I actually think those people exist, okay? I don't think I'm – now, they might say, well, realistically, you know, he's the one who's in the position. But do we just cede that territory to him and not make him accountable for some of the real serious failures that he's also brought to the office that have done real damage in certain areas? I mean, some of the things that we lift him up for, he deserves credit for, but the damage that he's done cannot be ignored because it's serious. And so I think a way of holding him accountable is a way to do it. Now, I think my own personal view is that his personality may be so flawed that that won't do him personally any good, but it will do our country and it will do our society a lot of good. And that's the distinction I'm pushing for.
Got it. And in the intro to the show, I stated things perhaps a little bit too plainly in terms of your position. So thanks for explaining it more plainly. If the clock was to stop right now, evangelicals, Donald Trump in terms of the good that he's done, and there are huge, that's the way I say it too, huge things he's done, massive accomplishments, and other things that are bad, some would say they're huge as well. In your view, for the overall good of America, big question, and I know you're a careful thinker, but big question. In your view, has President Trump, for the overall good of the country, done more harm than good or more good than harm?
Ooh, I think the harm that he's done to our body politic and the harm that he's done to the institutions and the way they are respected or disrespected is serious damage. So I think I'd give him more minus than plus. Having said this, here's another point I like to make to pro-Trumpers, because when I bring this up, they'll say, yeah, but the other side has done X, Y, and Z, almost as a justification for our willingness to also be able to do X, Y, and Z. And my point is, as Christians, we're supposed to be better than the world. We're supposed to be different than the world. We're not supposed to be like the world. And so when we act like the world and turn ourselves into another special interest group, just like the rest of the world, we open ourselves up to be a choice among many and we lose our distinctive. That's what I'm afraid we've given up with Trump. He has defended certain things that certainly are worth defending, and in certain cases, I've been very, very pleased with some of the decisions that he's made. But what he has done to us spiritually and emotionally as a community has been extremely damaging, and I can't give him a pass on that.
Expand on that. What has he done spiritually and emotionally to us as a community?
Well, think about the way he attacks our institutions simply because they're trying to hold him accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the doubt and the rot that has set in as a result of that. That I can't trust someone. He talks about the news as if it's fake news, but frankly, a lot of what they've reported has turned out to be true, truer than what he's represented to the public. What does that do to our environment when we need to be able to trust our government for what it says? And think about the way he's treated our allies, okay, some of the people who have stood with us and are closest to us, who he's belittled. And look at the people that he's lifted up and what their character is. I mean, there are a whole series of things at a moral, relational, character level in which he has done damage, he has failed. And those are not – those are as or more important as policy in the long term, in my view.
Got it. And again, friends, you may differ with Professor Bach, or you may be wanting me to take a more passionate stand against what he's saying. In point of fact, these are questions I ask all the time. This is a constant conversation my wife and I are having. And if the elections were today and it was Donald Trump against, say, Elizabeth Warren, I would vote for Donald Trump. However, I wrestle with these things as well. I opposed him hotly during the primaries. I would have rather seen Ted Cruz in office. And then I wonder, okay, I do believe, Darryl, as I look at it, the only way I can see Donald Trump being the president with all that was going against him was that God had a hand in it. But God could also be doing good through him and then giving us what we deserve and then revealing a lot of the rot that's in the church, the hypocrisy. God's the ultimate multitasker.
Yes, and I'm a little nervous about giving God too much credit for the presence of Donald Trump in the presidency. Not that I don't think that sovereignly it didn't happen, and that was part of what took place. But the point is that's another way we can cover over what we should be evaluating him on, and that sometimes bothers me as well. You know, is he Cyrus? You know, or is he Ahaz?
Nice.
People end up being in leadership positions. God allows it to take place, but that doesn't mean that he's put an imprimatur on the way in which they've led.
Right. And I asked, was he Cyrus or was he Nebuchadnezzar or, again, these various leaders? But what I've realized, I've always heard it in a certain way in terms of God doing something sovereignly, which does not put an approval on the person, but rather God had a purpose in it. But then others take it as a prophecy, and this is now God's anointed whom you can't question, which is really, really dangerous.
What if he's actually exposing how shallow the church has become in the West by adapting an ends justifies a means approach to issues tied to character and societal well-being?
I believe God is doing that. I don't question that for a split second. And that's why I said God's a multitasker. In other words, President Trump could be doing good with court appointees and various things like that. He could be doing good pushing back against abortion. He could be doing good for Israel, perhaps pushing back against Iran, getting nuclear arms, which are all massive things, which we deeply appreciate and reasons we voted for him. And at the same time, exposing a lot of the superficiality and hypocrisy in the church. All right. Take 45 seconds before the break and tell me why you, as a white professor at a major seminary in Dallas, Texas, have become concerned about the issue of racism.
Because I care about my fellow brothers in Christ, and I care about my fellow human beings, which is a core commitment of the Great Commandment, which is to love God with all my heart, mind, and soul, and love my neighbor as myself. And I've been told my neighbor is anyone.
Got it. Well, that was 15 seconds. All right, friends, we're going to come back and we're going to ask some hard questions. I'm going to do my best to let Darryl speak for the good part of the 12 minutes or so that we'll have left when we come back. But my guest, Professor Darryl Bach, if you don't have any of his books, if you're into deep study of the New Testament and who Jesus is, you got to get his books. If you want to know why were certain books not in the Bible and so on, popular stuff, and going back to the Da Vinci Code, Darryl Bach is the man to go to, B-O-C-K. I own many of his books and have greatly profited by reading them. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, speaking with Professor Darryl Bach today about the cultural issues, the divisive issues where the church stands, from the president to racism to pro-life issues, etc. And Darryl, you'll be glad to know that a lot of folks watching on YouTube disagree with you, so there'll be some good, healthy discussion there. Hopefully, friends, if you're going to discuss it in the way of substance rather than just attacking each other. So we're getting people thinking, and that's the whole purpose of this. You have really been burdened about issues concerning race, and we keep learning. My listeners have really helped enlighten me about many things that they've experienced growing up and dealing with that I never dealt with. So we all have blind spots. We keep learning and growing. But this has been something, as I've known you over the years, it seems to be a burden that's deepening in you. So talk to me plainly, and what's the church done right or wrong here?
Well, I think that race was a problem we thought we had solved in the 60s, and what we've shown is that we haven't solved it at all. And I think part of it is because our society is living in really two distinct worlds in many ways. You know, let me give you an example. You know, we talk about how in the African-American community, for example, that there ought to be more family values and that kind of thing, and that, you know, the stability is built around the family, all of which is true. But here's what we don't see corporately and structurally that we never deal with and when we make that statement, and that is that for decades, African-Americans in the context of slavery were put into context in which families were literally ripped apart by design. And so when you grow up in a society and in a context in which you lose a family, not by your own choice, but by the exercise of other people's prerogatives and power, then you set models for behavior and survival that aren't based around biblical values and family coherence and that kind of thing. But we take no responsibility for that as the part of the society that was somewhat responsible for those kinds of situations. To me, there are two kinds of racism. There's what I would call an active racism. When I talk about that, I'm talking about the white supremacist, the Ku Klux Klan person, that kind of thing. But there's another kind of racism that's completely passive. It's withdrawn from being aware of what's going on around them. It's a hesitation to speak into the injustice in one way or another. And what that does is perpetuate the structures that do push some people down by not asking questions about fairness and opportunity and those kinds of things. And by refusing to acknowledge or come to grips with the impact across generations of choices that were made, you know, three or four generations ago. And I call it passive because it's not active. There's not a maliciousness to it, okay? It's just there, and it is our lack of awareness of what has produced the situation that we're in that produces an insensitivity and a lack of appreciation for why we're in the circumstance that we're in, and then what really needs to be done to try and help deal with it, which is, you know, race is kind of an all hands on deck problem.
Right. So it's not Republican versus Democrat. It's we as followers of Jesus. What's our responsibility in society? You mentioned to me when we were in Toronto something very enlightening when you had interviewed Dr. Tony Evans. What happened?
I host a podcast called The Table. It's at voicedts.edu. That'll be the only promotion that I'll do. And in the midst of discussing race, Tony's a good friend, and I asked him, tell me what I, as a white person, as a Caucasian, don't get about being black in America. And the way he answered the question is he went through a list. It probably took him 5 minutes to go through it all, of a variety of experiences that he goes through on a regular basis or has to cope with on a regular basis simply because he is black, that I never even have to think about as a white person. Mm-hmm. It has to do with him. He's driving on the way to a Bible study in a rich part of Dallas, and he gets pulled over by a policeman simply because he's black and is asked, what are you doing in this part of town? It's the talk that most black parents have to have with their children about what to do if they're pulled over by a policeman in order to not put themselves in danger. You know, in the black community, this is often called the talk. I mean, it's that widespread. And so there are things like this that I never have to deal with that he deals with on a regular basis. And when you see that and feel that day after day after day, impacts your identity and the way you view the world in ways that I've never been touched. And so just being aware of that difference, this is the two worlds that I'm talking about, helps me to become more sensitive to the fact that someone else's experience in the society that we share is not necessarily the same experience that I've had.
Right. And again, with all of this, friends, what we're talking about is understanding. Daryl, I've shared with folks in multicultural, multiracial churches that when it comes time for elections, rather than avoid the issues, you ought to have some of the folks who are articulate from Hispanic, Black, White, Asian, etc., and say, hey, here's what's important to me and here's why I vote the way I vote. And they have a discussion. Just understand. Because, you know, I was talking to one Black leader in New York City, and he said, you're trying to get prayer back in the schools. I'm trying to get education back in the schools. And, you know, certain priorities that one group will have, the other doesn't understand. And when you're talking about people who love the Lord, who are people of the word, people of moral character, and then they vote in a way that just, how could you do that? I mean, we've tried to have these conversations on the air here, but that's the thing, to have the conversation, to listen. I have one African-American friend of mine who's constantly sending me headlines of outrageous things that happen, you know, like with a white cop that was leading a black guy that he'd arrested, you know, pulling him on a rope down the streets. Like, this is happening. So whether I think it's skewed or not, the fact is, I didn't know about this, or I didn't follow this, or I didn't know that. And it's like, that's the world I live in. So it's the awareness. We're not trying to be woke and be the social justice warriors. We're trying to be godly people that are following biblical teaching. It's that simple, isn't it?
Yeah, and I actually don't mind being woke in that sense. There's a sense in which I am blind and blinkered. And so being a good listener, you know, there's a real quick way to tell whether you're a good listener or not. And that is whether you're concentrating on what the person is saying to you in such a way that you could repeat it back to them and they would say, you got it. Yep. Or whether in your mind you're thinking about what your retort's going to be. You know, one is listening, the other is not. And so, you know, so when I have conversations with people from different backgrounds, I go in and I see myself as a person who's curious. I'm curious about life. I'm curious about the life experiences of other people, why they see the world differently than I do, that kind of thing. And I want to probe why that is. And then I do want to sort through that. I do want to be discerning about that. But I don't go in with an attitude that says, because you think differently than you do, I can't trust what you're saying to me. You know, I go into the conversation saying, no, you think differently than I do. I'm curious as to why. What's really going on? Is there something I might be missing that I need to hear? You know, that's the way I go into some of these conversations. And in the process, what I find is that when I send those vibes out to someone, because they're so used to our defensiveness in our culture today, when you send those vibes out to someone, it actually changes the nature of the conversation.
Yeah.
And you actually, in the end, get further. Because you get to the point where you're communicating a trust and a respect for the person to which they will respond. And so there's just a different way to go about doing what we're doing. It doesn't involve doubling down. It doesn't involve insulting someone because they think differently than you do. It's actually getting down into the nitty-gritty and trying to figure out where the differences are coming from and why.
You know, Daryl, when I started to get burdened about gay issues, that transgender wasn't really on the horizon as much back in 2004, but started to get burdened about gay and lesbian issues, I knew, okay, I'm burdened about the issues, now I need to get burdened for the people. And I went out of my way to talk with people, local activists, others. If I was flying and I could sense the person next to me was gay or lesbian or it's a conversation, I heard it, I'd interact with them. I'd tell them, this is who I am. I'm a Bible-believing follower of Jesus, but I want to know your story. Tell me your story. And I was 100% sure that God did not create that man to be with another man or that woman to be with another man and that he wasn't glorified through that. I was 100% sure, but I genuinely wanted to hear their story so I could better understand them as people and have more compassion for them. How much more when we're not talking about right and wrong issues as much as your life experience and what I can learn from it. So, Daryl, we've got a minute. Give us a closing word, a closing reflection.
Well, I think the thing that I've tried to say in the entire hour is the more consistent we are about living out the convictions that we have and who we are as the people of God, recognizing that we're that we will get pushback from the world. The more consistent we are, the more we underscore our credibility for everything else that we care about. And that's true whether we're talking about politics or, in particular, where we're talking about the gospel, or particularly where we're challenging people in moral areas. If we've been morally inconsistent in how we've interacted with the world, our credibility on moral questions goes down. And the same is true with regard to the gospel, which says that God cares about people and loves them very deeply. They ought to be able to see that love in the way I treat them.
Yeah, well said. So appreciated. And look, we are God's holy party. That's our ultimate affiliation, heavenly citizens living here in this world with kingdom values. Dow, keep up the awesome work. Friends, get some books by Darryl Bock, B-O-C-K. You keep writing. I'm going to try to catch you, buddy. God bless you.
Yeah, I keep smiling.
All right.